The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events, and I'm very pleased to welcome all of you this evening. We're here to talk about miracles. Sounds quaint, doesn't it? If you're like me, it's a topic that you left behind a long time ago. Burning bushes that speak, staffs becoming snakes, the lame made to walk, the blind to see, Congress in agreement with the president. Not possible, you say. Well, tonight, Eric Metaxas joins us to explore the phenomenon we think of as miracles, what they are, why they happen, and how they can change your life. He is the author of numerous books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, Spy, described as a weighty and riveting biography, and Amazing Grace, William Wilberforce and the Heroic Campaign to End Slavery, which served as the companion biography to a film of the same title. Metaxas was the keynote speaker at the 2012 National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., and it's a pleasure to have him join us at the library tonight. Please welcome Eric Metaxas.
Hello. Thank you for coming. I take it for granted that you've already voted. If you didn't vote, just slip out and take care of that, and you can come back for the Q&A. My name is, in fact, Eric Metaxas. Thank you, Andy, for that introduction. I want to save some good time for Q&A, because I think that's always fun, and I can say all kinds of things in the course of a Q&A. But I just want to say a few words up front to kind of frame things, I suppose. I don't know how many of you are familiar with my work or with me. If you are, would you be willing to raise your hand? You would be willing. Okay, then would you raise your hand? Okay, thank you. I want to tell you a little bit about my story because I think that's part of how I come to this subject. I was raised in the Greek Orthodox Church. My dad came from Greece in the mid-50s. My mom came from Germany. They met in an English class in New York City, no, I'm serious, and it is funny though, right? And I became a writer. I was an English major, and if you're raised Greek and German, that means you will be raised Greek. You understand? Have you ever met Greeks? That's the way it breaks down, and so I was raised, as I said, in the Greek Orthodox Church. It's really... for me, growing up in the Greek church, I was an altar boy. It's really a cultural experience more than it was a faith experience, right? I think it's where the Greeks kind of hang out on Sunday, and I know a number of you have experienced that kind of thing. Some people, especially immigrants, you know, if you're Portuguese or Italian or Irish, you kind of hang out with the other Portuguese, Irish, and Italian at church. It's part of that ethnic experience. And for us, that's what it was. And so it was a warm experience, a wonderful experience, but it was not a deeply Christian experience, as I learned when I went to Yale University, which is ever so slightly secular. I don't know if you're aware of that. I shouldn't bash Yale, because that's really only been true for the last 210 years. Before that, they were rock solid theologically. And so I went there utterly unaware of how little I knew about the faith that I thought I claimed. And I think for a lot of people in this culture, in the United States where I grew up, it's kind of like that. It's sort of an identity, but it's more like a tribal identity. You know, you check off Christian because you're not Jewish or Muslim or atheist, so I guess I'm a Christian, you know. But that's not the way it works. It's not a tribal identity. It's something different. And so I didn't really realize that till I went to Yale and my faith was challenged and I realized that I really had no idea what I believed. And it's a funny thing not to know what you believe. And I would say most people are in that situation where you're just not sure what it is that you believe. Some people do, but most of us don't really know. And I realized that for me, it really was a childhood kind of faith. I never rejected it boldly because my parents weren't, you know, fundamentalist or in any way overbearing. They also had no clue what they believed. It was just the thing you do on Sunday. You go and, you know, the morality of that world is, you know, be a good boy, get good grades, and whatever you do, marry a Greek. That was about it. And so I realized I don't know what I believed, and so I was trying in my way to, you know, come up with a theory of the universe. What's the meaning of life and all that kind of stuff. I wanted to be a writer. I knew that. And I was interested in meaning, you know, not just in words, although I'm very interested in words. But I was interested in meaning and the meaning of life, and I would read books like, you know, Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, or I remember reading Goethe's Elective Affinities. I remember reading these books and really thinking about the meaning of them more than the story. Just what is the meaning of life? What is this saying about life? And sort of reading books that way. I graduated Yale in 84, and I think that my longing for the answers to the meaning of life had not even begun to be answered. Yale doesn't do it that. Most of academia just doesn't go there. And I find that funny because I think you have to deal with those fundamental questions that pretty much every human being has. Who am I? Where am I going? Where do I come from? You know, what are some thoughts on this? And so I graduated a little bit frustrated and a little bit confused. And so I had a I put it this way. If you don't know the answers to those questions, they don't have to gnaw at you. All you have to do is distract yourself with a really good job or something like that for a few decades, and then it'll be over. Is that too bleak for you? And on the weekends, there's like, you know, alcohol and sports and stuff, so you can distract yourself. But, you know, wanting to be a writer, being an English major, I didn't get that good job to distract myself. I was really just floundering. With plenty of time on my hands to think about this stuff. And if you flounder and drift, as I did in my years after graduation, you pretty much end up moving back in with your parents, which is what happened to me. And I had a really miserable time, because if your parents happen to be European immigrants, you really don't want to move back in with them, because their attitude is like, we killed ourselves working menial jobs to send you to an Ivy League school, punk. So why don't you find yourself a job and move on? And it was really a hard time. In that time, I experienced what I can only call my first miracle. And I've had a number of them over the years. I'd never had one up to that point. I didn't think that they were possible. I didn't know if God existed. And I didn't know, I mean, these are the ultimate questions, right? We want to ask, does God exist? Is there something beyond this universe of time and space, the natural material universe? We all wonder, could there be something beyond it? If there is something beyond it, what is the nature of that something? And then the question is, can we know whether there is something? In other words, there may be something, but then there's the question, can we know whether there's something or isn't? And then finally, the question is, if there is something or someone beyond this universe, can we know that something personally? I think those are the four questions. And I was pondering these things, but I had been trained at Yale, of course, to avoid serious Christians, because, you know, they're crazy and they might, you know, blow you up or kill you or something like that. And I hope I'm not offending any suicide bombers in the crowd. I know that you mean well. And but so I met this guy who took the Bible really seriously, and we'd have these conversations, and I was always like, you know, don't come too close. But I was in enough pain to say, tell me more. Interesting. That's interesting. But I couldn't really buy it. I think I was just, I had drunk the Kool-Aid at Yale, where you just don't take that stuff seriously by definition. But I couldn't help but take it somewhat seriously. Then one night around my 25th birthday, I had a dream. I won't tell that story now. I tell that story in the book, but it was nothing less than a miracle. I didn't ask for it. God revealed himself to me in the dream in a way that utterly blew my mind. And I cannot, you know, I couldn't distance myself from it and say, oh, that was just a dream or what. I knew that this was real. Now, as much as I can know anything, I just knew it was real, and it changed everything for me. Now, I contrast that miracle, which changed my life, with something that happened about 3 months before. I was slightly open to this idea of God, but only slightly, and I remember being in misery. I would drive to work. I had a job as a proofreader at Union Carbide in Danbury, Connecticut. The Hebrew word is Gehenna. It was an utterly horrifying experience. And I remember flipping on the radio one morning, in really in this sort of psychic pain, misery, depression. And Robert Plant, the lead singer for Led Zeppelin, had a single, had an album out, solo album. And on it, there was a song called Heaven Knows. And it was like, you know, hitting the top of the charts. And I remember hearing this song, and in my angst and pain, wondering, you know, because I was, every now and again, I would say, God, if you're there, give me a sign. But I didn't believe, I thought I was talking to the oxygen in the room, and I'd get embarrassed having prayed that. But I remember thinking, I wonder if God is out there, and if heaven does know. I mean, I was actually listening to this song and thinking, does heaven know? Does heaven know me? Do I know? You know, I had this desire to simply know whether there is a God out there or not. And I remember pulling into the parking space in this horrible parking lot garage thing. Just thinking about it makes me want to kill myself, but so I'll try to make this quick. But it was so depressing, this corporate environment. And, you know, I'm a writer, poet, humorist. I'm not really a corporate kind of guy. So I remember being just so depressed. And I pull into the parking lot, the song's playing, and I did one of those things that you do maybe when you're 24. I said, okay, God, if you're there, when I come back out in 8 hours, let the song be playing when I come out. You know, and it was playing on the radio then. I was like, I click it off and I go in and do my proofreading of manuals of chemical symbols and things. So, you know, I come back out 8 hours later, I turn on the radio, and boom, there's the song. And I'll never forget thinking, wow, what am I supposed to think right now? Can I believe that this is some kind of miracle that I prayed this prayer 8 hours ago, and then having forgotten all about it, now I turn it on and there's Robert Plant singing the song. It really blew my mind. And I remember driving out of the concrete bunker and thinking, God, are you there? Are you real? Are you real? Can you hear me right now? I mean, it was an extraordinary thing for me. I'd never experienced anything like that, even being willing to believe that that might be true. And there was a kind of exuberance and an ecstasy. And then I pretty much forgot all about it, because I think my logical mind said, look, this is just a coincidence. Robert Plant's song is like in the top 10. I think it was even number one briefly. They play top 40 on that radio station. You know, that's like not necessarily a miracle. So you don't want to base your life on a coincidence. And so I didn't. I just kind of drifted off. But 3 months later, I had this dream. And the dream, as I said, changed everything. And since then, 26 years ago, I have had a number of what I would call genuinely miraculous experiences. Now, you know, you don't have to believe me, but I'm telling you, I don't take that idea of miraculous experience lightly, right? I'm not talking about a coincidence. I'm talking about things that seem straight up shocking, like, you know, the parting of the Red Sea. You don't go, eh, who knows? It's a miracle if that actually happened. And so it's made me over the years think about this kind of stuff. I've met many people who are really devout Christians who've never had an experience like this. I wrote two biographies, one of Wilberforce and one of Bonhoeffer. Neither of them seems to have experienced anything along these lines. So you could be a devout person of faith and not experience this kind of thing. But I've met many people who have experienced these kinds of things, some more than others. And so it's intrigued me. But I never planned to write a book about miracles until a couple of years ago. I was having lunch with an editor in New York in Soho, and I told him one of these stories that had happened to me. And I probably got about, I don't know, 8 or 10 really what I would call bona fide miracle stories. And I told him one of them, you know, and, you know, his eyes bugged out and he said, oh, you've got to write a book on miracles. And I said, well, that's nice, but I don't really want to write a book on miracles. And he kept bugging me for literally a year, at least a year, strongly saying, you've got to, you know, putting an offer on the table, you've got to do this. And then finally he said, if you don't do this, I'm going to find somebody else, because this is a really big topic and somebody needs to do this, whatever. And my wife said, you know, you should do this, because this is the kind of a thing that typically gets screwed up one way or the other, right? In other words, I feel this is so important because it's sort of at the heart of everything. You're asking about the nature of reality. So it's not necessarily just a religious question. It's a question about the nature of reality. And you're asking, is there anything beyond this universe? Any cosmologist or physicist worth his salt is asking that question. And everyone should be asking that question, and you can come up with whatever conclusion you like. But I thought, this is something that's bigger than just, do I believe the Red Sea was parted? Do I believe the burning bush happened? What do I, you know, it's a bigger question. And typically, it's dealt with either in a very religious way, where more secular people just kind of blow it off. It's like, that's, you know, that crazy thing. It's like golf for people who don't play golf. Like, yeah, I'm just not interested. Thank you very much. Or it's like the Bass Fishing Channel for people who don't fish. You know, you just go, hey, I'm not judging you. It's just that I don't fish for bass, so I'm going to keep flipping. And then on the other side, you have people who are very convinced in their secularity, and they pretty much sneer at the whole idea. They don't even allow for the possibility of that. And I thought, you know, that's just not right. Most people are someplace in the middle. They're kind of open. They just say, whatever is, is. Like, I might not like the implications, you know, if I find out that there's this God of the universe. But I mean, if it's true, I'm interested in knowing about it. And if it's not true, I don't want to worship a God who doesn't exist. You know, most people, I think, in America are someplace there. But we typically don't have conversations that are respectful of both sides and open this up. So I was convinced by my wife and this editor that I should write the book. I didn't know really what I was going to write, so I just started writing, and I ended up with a lot of what I call C.S. Lewis light observations, you know, L-I-T-E, light. It's not intended to be definitive or anything like what Lewis wrote, but it's intended to be ruminating on the question of miracles. Why do they sometimes happen and sometimes don't happen? What role would prayer have? How can we know whether something's a miracle or not? I thought these things are worth talking about, not necessarily coming up with answers. In some cases, maybe, in some cases, maybe not. But I thought that this is something that we don't seem to ever really look at seriously. And I think that part of the problem is that in our culture, we treat spirituality, religion, God stuff as though it is utterly subjective. And I think that's a problem, because it's either real or it's not. It doesn't mean you can know every detail of it, but to act like, hey, whatever you want to believe, that's cool. It's not cool. If you're believing in stupid things that don't exist, somebody should tell you, you know what? The God you're praying to doesn't exist. But we have this attitude, especially in America, that, well, you know, whatever works for you, whatever works for you. So if your religion, you know, if you hate blacks and Jews, God bless you, go ahead and do that, right? No, we don't go that far, right? So we're hypocrites, you know, it's not whatever. We have this kind of tension between, is it real and good? But then we don't look too closely. I think that if we do it respectfully, civilly, we can look more closely. We can talk about these things. We can even talk about things like, you know, the resurrection of Jesus. Did that really happen? What can we know? We don't have to prove anything to each other, but let's have a civil conversation. I think this subject warrants a civil conversation. Part of the divide, again, that I was just talking about, you know, you've got these hyper-spiritual people, and then you've got these hyper-secular people. They both kind of sneer at each other and don't take each other's positions very seriously. I think it's a problem. And I think, you know, you get along the lines of this divide, you get people who are so critical of faith stuff that they're ultimately sneering of it. They're not open-minded to the possibility. It's more like to criticize just to sneer or to disprove. And then you get other people who are so open that they're really gullible and they ought to be more critical. And I think that, you know, we ought to try to meet someplace in the middle, bring an open-mindedness to the subject, and yet a critical quality, so that we're not being foolish. You know, let's be careful. And again, you get this divide between faith and science, which is another false divide, as far as I'm concerned. There's no real incompatibility between faith and science. That whole idea is a joke to me, because it's a very, very shorthand, sloppy way of saying, I don't like that stuff. You know, like both sides, like, I don't want to talk about it. That's not rational, and it's not mature. Science is an attempt to examine this world, right? And any person of faith ought to be pro-science, right? And I think that this idea that science is at odds with faith, or that people of faith are inherently illogical or irrational, is totally wrong. And I think that the history of faith would argue against that. But we tend only to hear examples that argue for it, right? You know, you hear about the Inquisition, you hear about this, but, you know, there's plenty of examples of people whose faith led them to serious scientific inquiry. And we ought to be aware of that. And we ought to be aware that there are many scientists today, serious scientists, who are men and women of faith, you know, and I've met some of them and interviewed some of them. So as I say, this is kind of a false divide, and I think we ought to be having a conversation. So in the book, I talk about that stuff up front, and I talk about something I hadn't intended at all to talk about. I say, okay, what is a miracle? And I say that, you know, we know that the parting of the Red Sea, like, that's a miracle, right? We don't have to, you know, say if it happened, it's a miracle. The resurrection, if it happened, that's a miracle. If somebody prays for a tumor and the tumor goes away, you say, well, you know, that's a miracle. We know typically what we mean by miracle. But what about when somebody says something like, oh, life is a miracle? You know, is that just a Hallmark cliche? On the one hand, it can be. On the other hand, I said, let's look at the existence of life on Earth and how fragile it is from a scientific point of view. And then let's look at the existence of the universe the way cosmologists would look at it. You know, the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, what was necessary for that to happen? What happened right after that that allowed the universe to be created? When you look at it from a scientific point of view, you see that most scientists seem to have this consensus of this idea of a fine-tuned universe, that it's if things were just a little different here or here or here or here or here or here or 150 variables, if they were just a little different, the whole thing can't happen. Now, most of us don't really know that. And I think if that's true, that's pretty extraordinary. Whatever you end up believing, just being aware of that. And I think part of the dirty little secret of some scientists is that they know this, but it makes them uncomfortable, so they don't talk about it, right? Because the implications are frightening. Fred Hoyle, who coined the term Big Bang, I guess was in the 50s, his understanding of this fine-tuned universe, now he's one of the top, you know, physicists in the world, he said it shook his atheism. Now, he never changed from his atheism, but it was really shaken when he looked at how things had to be exactly so. Now, if you're not a physicist, and I'm not, that I'm aware of, thank you, then you know, some of this stuff sounds a little arcane. In the book, I only typically refer to the simpler stuff that we can all understand, but it's fascinating, and it's led me to conclude that the existence of life on Earth is so outrageous that it's a miracle that makes the parting of the Red Sea look like a joke, frankly. You know, and again, you can read the book and see what you think, but it's astounding. So I think that this idea of science being somehow at odds with faith, I think the tremendous irony, and again, you just don't hear this very much, is that science seems, if anything, the more we learn, 50 years ago, we couldn't do this, but now, in the last 50 years, we've learned more and more and more and more about the nature of the universe, and that if anything, it's pointing to the concept of a creator God, an intelligent creator. Again, whether you accept it or not, the fact that science seems to be pointing that direction is, as far as I'm concerned, that's like front page news. And so, you know, but it doesn't seem to be on the front page or on any page. It's just the thing that I think that a lot of times culture is decades behind what's happening, you know, and that most of us are still like in the 60s in terms of, you know, like Carl Sagan in the 60s was saying that, the universe is all there is. And in terms of life, well, you know, there's probably 100 million planets in the known universe that could support life, because he only had two criteria that were necessary at the time. But as the years have passed since he made that statement in 1966, scientists have come up with more and more criteria. They say, no, you got to have this, and then you got to have this, and you got to have all these different things. And as the years have passed, these numbers have increased and increased and increased, so that, you know, that number of 100 million went down to zero, and then continued way below zero to where the odds against their existing life anywhere in the universe are absolutely astronomical. I mean, you know, like 10 to the 50th power kind of stuff. So, again, we should be able to talk about those numbers and those things and ruminate together and sort of reason together. And whatever we end up believing, that's another story. But at least let's look at the facts. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I think if you do conclude that there is a God in the universe, it's, you know, you want to talk about a paradigm shift. It's kind of a big thing if that's not where you're starting. It was for me. And I should say that the second half of the book is miracle stories, some of which, just a few, are my stories, but most of them are stories from friends. And I decided at some point only to include stories of people that I knew personally. I said, I'm not going to scour the known universe like Robert Ripley. I'm going to... a few people chuckled. Isn't that wonderful? Thank you. I said, I'm going to only tell the stories of people that I know personally. I think most of them, like, you know, 95%, a couple people that I actually did know, but I don't know them as well. But most of the people I know very well. And I said, those are the stories that I want to tell. And because it removes, at least for me, a layer of the credibility problem. You know, I know that these people aren't crazy. I've known them for years. And I just think that it's interesting. And then I sort of throw these things out there and I say, what do you make of it? You tell me what you make of it. Do you think that this guy's crazy? Do you think he lied with you? You know, there's a number of options, but I think, logically speaking, most of them you have to reject. And then you just stuck with these testimonies of people telling these stories, just like me, you know, telling my story of my dream, this miracle story, which I didn't tell you. And I'll say this and then I'll stop so we can have some Q&A. But what I find funniest is that it's all about the details. People often say to me, well, tell me a miracle story quickly, you know. And you can't tell it quickly because it's sort of this, it's like the setup to a joke. If you get the whole thing, then you can really see what happened. So the framing is very, very important. All the details are important so that you kind of get it, you know, so you sort of understand what it is that supposedly happened. But in some cases, I mean, they're all different kinds of miracle stories in the book. And as I said, I know these people and I vetted this, you know, I asked a lot of questions. Say, wait a minute, what about this? What about this? Some people are not good at telling stories and you find that there's holes and questions. And so I had to really, you know, tease out things before I said, okay, I get it. So I'll write it up. But anyway, why don't I stop there so we can have some Q&A. You can ask me anything you like, but I prefer true or false questions. Thank you. This is a question right here.
I have two questions. I'm over here.
Hi.
Where's your mother born in Germany?
In a tiny village called Großstöbnitz, which is near Altenburg, which is near Leipzig.
Oh, that would be northern Germany.
No, that is eastern Germany.
Okay. Well, my other question was, when I'm almost finished with the Bonhoeffer book, and I am just beside myself with the journey I'm on in this thing. Where did you get all the information that you're, it's just so infinite in its detail. Where did you compile the information from?
Wikipedia. I hate to say that, but that's true. I was in a rush, and you know what? Most of it's fine. No, actually, people think I did more work than I did. And I don't mean that I didn't do a lot of work. It just about killed me. But so much of Bonhoeffer's writings, almost all of them, have been collected and translated into English recently, right? So I had 16 volumes of his writings to work with. There have been a number of biographies written on him. His best friend, Eberhard Baker, wrote this 11-page, huge, you know, brick of a book. So there's tons of information. For me, it was more, what do I leave out? But in fact, in the Miracles book, one of the stories that I write about my own experience is the experience of writing the Bonhoeffer book. I had a really miraculous experience happen, like mind-blowing. And writing the book was actually very painful. It was sort of the trial of my life. But in the middle of it was this outrageous, truly outrageous miracle. And whatever, you can read it if you read that book. But it was extraordinary. And I think sometimes, you know, when you think about why does God do miracles or whatever, we can't pretend to have easy answers. But one of the things that I think that factors in is when we need a miracle, right? In other words, when we're desperate, it's typically then, I would say, typically that you know, you hear from God or something happens. But I was really in a kind of agony, and in the midst of that, this thing happened. And you know, the funny thing is, you'd rather that the thing never happened, that you just don't go through the agony and just skip them both. But that's the way it broke down. So thank you.
Two related questions. How do you define a miracle? That is, are you defining it as a suspension of the laws of the universe? And two, how does that translate to God's particular interest in you as opposed to other people?
Right. Great questions. Well, I think Hume and others have defined miracles that way, that somehow it's a suspension of the laws of the universe. It's complicated, because what I say is that a miracle is when something beyond this universe, which is to say beyond time and space, like the created universe that, you know, came into being at the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, give or take a fortnight, something beyond that speaking into that. So it's kind of like putting energy into a system, adding energy to the system. I think it's either C.S. Lewis or John Lennox, who's an Oxford mathematician that I quote a lot in the book. They talk about that idea that a miracle is when, I mean, for example, in the idea of the virgin birth, that's a miracle, but then once that miracle happens, the laws of nature take over, and a baby forms along the lines of the laws of nature. But I would say, roughly speaking, that's what a miracle is. I say that a miracle is also the New Testament word, the Greek word is semeios, which means a sign. And I find that interesting. It's better than the word miracle, because a sign is, you know, you say a sign of what? What does it signify? And a sign always points to something beyond itself. I mean, it's not about itself. It's pointing beyond itself. And I would say that miracles always point to God, or point to the author of the miracle, or point beyond themselves to whatever it is that's beyond this universe. That's kind of the point. Because if you think about the Red Sea, for example, you say, well, what was the point of that? Clearly the point of that was Yahweh trying to communicate with his people. He could have found a less dramatic way to save them, but somehow he chose to do it that way so that they would remember forever and mark this forever. That's the point. And you realize that God could have done it differently, but he chose to do it this way to be dramatic, to make a point. Similarly, in the New Testament, the story of Lazarus, you say, well, Jesus could have prayed for Lazarus when he was sick. He didn't need to wait for him to die and then to raise him from the tomb after 4 days of decomposition. And so, you know, you think, why did he do it that way? It's the same thing. In other words, he did it to sort of show the power of God to people who evidently needed to know, is this God? Is this? And so, for me, a miracle, technically speaking, is God speaking to us about himself. It's not just about the thing that happens. But anyway, that's a little bit subjective in and of itself, but I thought it was interesting.
I actually have two questions. Do you have any children?
I do.
All right. Then in your acknowledgments, and I have to praise you, your acknowledgement list is so short, I admired it. It's not filled
I've been with criticized for that.
It is not filled with all these names.
Yeah.
But you do say that you credit certain people for your spiritual guidance.
Mm.
It's not the word religious guidance, it's spiritual. Could you talk more about that spiritual guidance?
I don't remember who I guess maybe am I referring to those two churches at the end? Yeah, well, when I had this experience in 1988, this dream, I started going to an Episcopal church in Darien, Connecticut. And I was astounded. It's not your typical Episcopal church in a sense. I mean, this was a place of robust faith where they were praying for miracles and stuff. They weren't really wacky. It was quite an amazing place, but it was an early tutelage in this, that this stuff is real, and that it, you know, at the same time you have to be sober-minded about it. You don't want to be, you know, bouncing around the room. But it was kind of interesting to me that they took it seriously. These were intelligent people, and you know, there's always you can always see abuses, but at the same time, I was I was interested in that. Following that, I started going to a church in Manhattan called Times Square Church, which is very different. It's not quite Pentecostal, but it's very lower income, mixed race, just a whole different experience, unlike anything I'd ever experienced. And the faith in that room, when I remember first going there, I thought, this is incredible. And, you know, a lot of these people are just, you know, getting off a crack or whatever. I mean, this is real for them. They're not like going to a nice church. This is about overcoming their pains and their difficulties and stuff. But it was so affecting to me. And it's a little bit like Bonhoeffer when he goes to Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. You know, he'd never seen anything like it. Like, whoa, this is real. This is not people playing church on a Sunday morning. But yeah, I just was interested in the way these people took that stuff seriously, but they didn't make an idol of the experience, because you see that too. Some people, that they're chasing after the miraculous. They don't really care about the God behind the miracles. It's more like they're chasing after some kind of experience, which I think is ultimately unhealthy. You know, that's not really the point of it. So that's all I'll say. There's a question right there.
I assume from what I've heard here that you accept the idea that there's a divine intervention in the affairs of our lives from time to time that works positive and amazing results. My question to you is, how do you reconcile that with all the horrible things that happen without benefit of divine intervention, which we would have really liked?
I thought, if somebody doesn't ask that question, this is a very dull crowd. So thank you for redeeming your brethren. That's the question. That is the question. And I don't pretend to have an easy answer for that. I deal with it in the book in some ways simply by raising it, saying, what are we to make of a God who, on the one hand, see, this is what I find interesting is that we sometimes feel like I've got to come to a conclusion one way or the other, right? Either God's a jerk that I don't want to know, or he's really wonderful, or whatever. But I think to myself, in science, we don't do that, right? We look at evidence. So if I had an experience, a miraculous experience, and another one, that's evidence that I've got to now deal with, right? So I think about the Holocaust, I think about horrible things, and I have to look at both. I may not be able to easily reconcile them, but I think the idea that that horrible things happening sweeps away the idea of a loving God. I can't sweep away these experiences I've had. I'm stuck. I mean, no one else may be stuck with my experiences, but I absolutely feel like I'm stuck. I've got to figure this out, you know? And part of the answer, I mean, I think the theological answer is just this doctrine of the fall, right? That things aren't the way they're supposed to be. Things are broken. There's evil and sin and death in this world. So the God of the Bible kind of comes in as a rescuer, as a savior. This is not, this isn't the way things are supposed to be, right? And so it's my understanding that the God of the Bible is, he's with us in the pain, trying to redeem things. But when we say, like, you know, a child is killed, and we go, like, why did God do that? I would say, well, you know, God didn't do that. That's sort of, we live in this broken world. And so when people say, like, oh, God needed an angel in heaven, or something, I said, that's bad theology. That's just wrong. I would say that, to some extent, that's against God's will. And so that's where it gets complicated, because we're talking about a God who, on the one hand, is all powerful, but who does not, but because of free will, because of the presence in this world of these things that I would say are a result of the fall, whatever you make of the fall, it's complicated. So I can't really give an easy answer to that. But I do think that you're getting at what I try to get at in the book is this idea that to not think about that is ridiculous. Like, you have to somehow, you have to put that into the equation.
Maybe the response is that you don't want to face the truth that there is no God,
right?
And that the evil and terrible things that you're talking about are part of nature as it exists. Mm. And we want to have the benefit of a heavenly Father and all this other good stuff, and we seek it out when we can find it, to make ourselves feel better.
Right. Well, but you haven't heard what I said before. I think that we're supposed to, first of all, I want to say, yes, we should be open to whatever is, right? Whether, in other words, I don't want to believe in a God who's not there, but I don't want to reject a God who is there just because I'm confused about some things. And my experiences have been such, not just my experiences, but let's just talk about the experiences, have been such that I am stuck. I have had experiences which leave me with very little doubt that God is real. So what I make of this other stuff, that's another story. But I can't, one thing I cannot do is say that this is Freudian wish fulfillment on my part. I'm not in a place to do that. Just because there are people who live like that. Maybe they've never had an experience and they just wish that, you know, they want to believe in Santa Claus. For me, that's not what it is. So that's why I respect questions like this, because I think that they have to be dealt with. Another question from this side.
Eric, is there room for a less dramatic notion of miracles? As I'm hearing you talk, it's a summons. It's something very significant that happened, a kind of an intervention. And I guess maybe the biblical image or one of the many of them would be like struck dumb on the road to Damascus, that kind of thing. But what about the notion of just a mindfulness about life, an alertness to life, you know, sort of like...
Well, I think that's part of it.
And then starting to see life differently, it communicating to you differently, but not with the drama that's implicit in a miracle with a capital M. Is there room for that in the way you're...
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that I don't think it's either or. I think it's both, right? In other words, I think that we should... I think when you read the first chapters where I talk about this fine-tuned universe, it's so astounding that most of us have to marvel at life, at the universe. I mean, that to me is appropriate. But going beyond that, what you're saying, being present and stuff, I think that's correct. I just don't think that we want to say, I mean, you know, if you're standing someplace and the Red Sea is parted, you've got to deal with that. Just like I'm saying, I've had a number of experiences. And, you know, if you read the book, you'll see that I'd love, this is my thing. It's like, I'd love to know what people make of some of these stories. What do you say happened here? Did this person hallucinate? Did they lie? I think it becomes very tough to say that about most of these. And so you have to say, wow, I at least can say, I don't know what happened. But you can't really dismiss these things. And this is part of what I'm saying is that, you know, some of us experience these things and we didn't want to, let's put it that right. I mean, I think of C.S. Lewis saying that he was the most reluctant convert in all of England. He was miserable. Like, he had this experience and he sort of stuck. That's kind of how I felt, in a way. I knew that all my Yale friends are going to, you know, think I flipped my lid or whatever. But what are you supposed to do at that point? Just dismiss that experience? You're stuck, you know, and you have to kind of deal with it. So I think I would say it's both. That's my answer. Yes, there's some questions here. Maybe in the... Okay.
I'm in the position of someone who wants to believe but feels kind of skeptical. I've bought your book, and I'm looking forward to reading it. But I'm thinking of maybe sort of a cynical way of looking at it by saying that a miracle is just something that we don't have an explanation for right now. And if we knew more and did more research, we'd have an answer.
It could be, but I think that can be glib. I think that there are times when that's the case, but I think that I've experienced a number of things where I would say that would be the glib answer in that case. Doesn't mean it's not conceivably possible, but again, we have to use our minds to sort of weigh things. And, you know, if somebody says that, you know, the thunder, that's the gods, whatever. I mean, we're not talking about that kind of stuff here. You know, we're not talking about the God of the Gaps. So, I would say, see what you think. I really, again, part of this is to get people to engage on a more granular level with this, because when we talk very theoretically, we're missing stuff. When you talk to someone who's had a specific experience, you have to deal with this. Are they crazy? Do they hallucinate? What, you know, and I have, as I say, had a number of these experiences, and I've talked to innumerable people who've had tremendous experiences, and it is my sober estimation that there's something there. Now, just because I can't tell you precisely what that something is, but it can't just be, you know, you know, 100 years from now, we'll know what that is. I think it's, again, I think that's too easy. That sort of sweeps things away in the same way that somebody who just wants to believe sweeps away doubt. I think, you know, we've got to kind of deal with both. There's some people in the middle here that we're not getting to.
Yes, well, first of all, I relate very much with your story. I have two Greek parents. And
two Greek parents? And I'm so sorry.
Everything this man says is true. Anyway, to me, there is no doubt. I mean, when we talk about God, there, for me, because of my own experiences, and they started happening at a young age. And I think what I hear you say is that once that happens and you believe, and there's, you know, 50 people can say, you're nuts, it doesn't matter. So I think faith has something to do with this. And there's one story, a mini miracle. I have actually experienced spontaneous healing. I have a friend, and I wanted you to see where you were on this. And she's a very middle of the road, you know. And she said to me, well, yeah, you have all these miracles and God and everything, but, you know, I had a wart that I did what my friend's mother told me to do. And, you know, when the full moon is there, you close your eye. Oh, no,
you kill a cat at the crossroads.
I'm sorry?
That's what you kill a cat at the crossroads. That's what you're supposed to do.
No, not this one. No, you keep your eye on the moon. You go down. You pick up whatever's the first thing, and you rub it on your wart. And she said the wart disappeared. And I said, why? I mean, did you think it was going to disappear? She goes, oh, absolutely. And even though God had nothing to do with it, she believed.
Okay.
And that, I think, is a big...
Well, I mean, look, we're talking about a lot of things. First of all, I would say that even if you've had a miraculous experience like I have, you still have to be critical about it. You can't just say, okay, that's God. You have to think, wait a minute, maybe it's not God. Maybe it's something within, you know, time and space that has affected this, right? I mean, I say this in the book, that if you pray for a tumor and the tumor goes away, it's possible that that was God. It's also possible that it was not God, and we have to be utterly logical, because if you're gilding the lily, you know, you kind of wreck the lily. And so I think that we have to be careful about, you know, when things happen, really trying to figure it out. I also say that if there's a spiritual realm, if you allow that there's a spiritual realm, it's not all good, right? In other words, all kinds of things can happen. And that's not necessarily the God of the Bible. You know, it could be, there could be dark forces. There could be, you know, you have to be, as I say, try to be logical about it. And I think sometimes people leap to the conclusion that they're looking for, right? I've seen that plenty in the Christian realm. Not always, but I've seen it. And part of what I want in this book is to get those people to think more critically and saying, God doesn't really need your help. He doesn't need you to spin the story. If it's real, it's real. And if it's not real, blow it off, you know. So anyway, it's complicated, yeah.
I have a number of friends who are missionaries overseas, and it's very common to hear about miracles from them, kind of the uppercase miracles and the lowercase M miracles. And I find that is in contrast to kind of what I experience and see in the U.S. And I'm wondering, is that because we're numb to it, or do you think,
there's a number of explanations, and this is one of these things too, that the answer is we don't know. So we can speculate that it's because they're primitive and they'll believe anything, and we're smart, sophisticated Western people that aren't fooled. That's one explanation, mm-hmm. which I'm sure some
which
people would put out there, and I'm sure there's some truth to that. I would say I think it has to do with an openness to the spiritual. I think that people in other cultures are much more open to it, and that seems to have something to do with the manifestation of it. Again, I don't know. These are speculations. I think that it also comes to, I was mentioning earlier, but the level of desperation, the level of need for a miracle, you know, I think that's part of it. But these are mysteries, and that's why it's very we have to be careful not to say it's this or this or this or this. We don't know exactly what it is. But we know that that's true. In other words, we know that there are many more accounts from third world countries and whatever. And again, I just want to say that we should look at it, you know, like scientists, so to say. Like, we don't know what we believe, but we know that we have, you know, X many accounts here and, you know, this many accounts here, and try to figure that out. Don't leap to conclusions, but sort of, you know, I would love to. A guy named Craig Keener has written a 2-volume sort of magisterial, authoritative, academic work on this. I think it's the only one of its kind. And so there's very little like that out there, but I would love to see a little rigor brought to this kind of thing to see if we can see patterns and draw conclusions. And if not, fine. You know, we don't need to. So there's a man in the back.
I just have a question about your feelings about being open to these things happening. I'm thinking in particular the 2 stories, the burning bush and the parting of the Red Sea. I personally feel that if Moses was walking along today, he would probably be on his iPod and miss the burning bush altogether. But it was the fact that he noticed that the bush wasn't being consumed, and that's when God supposedly talked with him. And also with the Red Sea, there was one of the Israelites actually started walking into the Red Sea up to his nose, apparently, and that's when it's sort of that going out and being present, you know, to something happening.
Right. I mean, I think we can overstate that, right? In other words, we don't want to make it so subjective that it's all about noticing the miracles. As I said, the story of Lazarus, to use an example, you don't have to believe it, but I'm saying to illustrate the point, it wasn't about, you know, some people were aware that he came out of the tomb. Or so. I mean, either he did or he didn't, and it's a dramatic thing. And I think that we have to, in some ways, for the purposes of clarity, we want to focus on those. We know that there's an endless subjectivity where, you know, somebody notices something miraculous. You see, that's in a way, that's another subject. I'm talking about things like, you know, did Lazarus rise from the dead or not? That's the question. It has little to do with the people around. Do they notice it or whatever? You know, was he a rotting corpse who was resurrected or not? That's the question. And I say, if not, then I don't want to believe it is. And if so, even if I can't explain it, I have to just sort of puzzle over it, or at least say I don't know or whatever. And so I think there's a temptation to subjectivize things and to say that, well, he noticed that the bush was burning. I don't think that's the point of the story. The simple point of the story is that there was a bush that was burning, you know, like in the desert, and God spoke through, you know, it's not like he could have missed that. God was speaking in a loud voice through a bush. Typically, that doesn't happen. And not to me, actually twice, but no, so. But I mean, you know, it's like it's supposed to be dramatic. That's kind of the point. So,
but my question really is your own openness to things happening. Do you have a certain approach?
As I said, I think it's both. In other words, I want to be open-minded, but I don't want to be foolishly open-minded. I only want to see what's actually happening. I don't want to read into it, and I see error on both sides, and that's part of what I'm trying to get at, is that, you know, what is. When it comes to science, we look at things that way, you know what I mean? And we all have different perspectives, but, you know, beryllium is not iron, you know? We take it seriously on some objective level, and I think we need to focus on that part of it before we get into the subjectivity too much. There's a question right here. You've got the microphone. How can I argue with you? Look at this guy.
Do you believe in a suffering God?
Do you bring that microphone with you?
Yeah.
Do I believe in a suffering God?
In the face of genocide.
In the face of genocide.
9/11.
Well, yeah. In other words, to me, the God of as a Christian, that's my idea of God, that he suffers with us. And again, this is also a mystery, but the idea that God is aloof, you know, up on the clouds, behind the clouds, indifferent, that's not the God I see. If there is a God, he is the God who suffers with us, who loves us, who's with us in the suffering. I've experienced that. that changes things. I think that a lot of times we have this idea of God as a distant, capricious, aloof deity, if he exists. And if he does exist that way, most of us would rather ignore him. I would, right? But if he's a God who, you know, it's like if you think of a parent who, you know, I would say, I would die for my daughter in a second. I would suffer for my daughter and die for her. Most parents are that way, that you say, I would die for you. That's a whole different thing than an authoritarian jerk who's just commanding you or just making rules. It's a whole different thing. It's love at its rawest. And, you know, agape love is self-giving love, which means that I would die for you. I serve you. That, to me, is the God of the Bible, which is very different from, you know, the Greek gods or any number of kinds of gods we can talk about. So, yeah.
Two blocks from here, there's a monument to a local Philadelphia priest, John Newman, who was canonized, which means he was declared a saint by the Catholic Church. In order to have that acknowledgement, you have to have a committee in Rome,
right,
evaluate whether three miracles occurred. Here's the three miracles for him. I just want to have you hear what you have to say about him. The first person was a young girl who had appendicitis, and she got better. The spontaneous cure rate for appendicitis is about 20%. The next person was in a car accident, multiple broken bones, got better. And the third case was a young boy who had a tumor, a cancer, and he got better after he received chemotherapy and radiation. So these were verified, quote, verified miracles. I was wondering if you thought John Newman should be a saint.
I have no idea. I mean, I'm not a Catholic, so I'm not too familiar with that process. One thing I want to say, though, and again, most people probably aren't aware of this, how fascinating that the Catholic Church has a very rigorous way of trying to determine was it a miracle or not. Whatever you think of it, just the idea that they really, you know, they put you through your paces. They don't say, oh, that's a great miracle. That's a miracle. They have people looking at it. Now, what you just described, none of that sounds particularly miraculous to me, so I feel a little bit confused. Chemotherapy kind of, you know, screws with the equation. So, and bones typically heal. And so I'm a little confused by that. So I don't know, and I certainly am not in position to decide who should be a saint or not. But I do think that the idea that the Catholic Church takes the whole thing seriously enough to be critical and to, in many cases, say that's not a miracle, that's interesting. That's not the side we often hear, right? We don't often hear that there is that rationality involved, no matter what you think of the Catholic Church, no matter what you think of the concept of miracles. The idea that they are trying to be clear and to be real and say that isn't, whatever. That, to me, it's the sort of thing that we ought to be more aware of it. And I think maybe part of what interests me is this false idea, which I was talking about in the beginning, that people of faith are somehow anti-rational or anti-scientific. That, as far as I'm concerned, couldn't be farther from the truth. Whatever one's conclusions are, I think that's it's a really unfair caricature of people of faith. And so I reject it. Not just for myself, but for so many people that I know who they're not interested in some sloppy kind of, pseudo-rational or irrational faith. And so I think what the Catholic Church does is, it speaks to that. So anyway, thank you. Thank you, all of you, I have to say, tremendous questions. Thank you very much. I'll be here to sign books as long as you're willing to hang around. And I won't only sign copies of my books, I'll sign copies of Faulkner and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, just in case you have any of those that you're looking for a signature. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.